The following discussion is not necessarily the views of all involved. The goal is to start open and honest discussion in the Christian worldview. Like all things, weigh what you hear with what you know and join us in our pursuit for the truth. Enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to Second Rate Emos.
Why is this what we're doing? Did you grab the head? No, did you grab the head?
Feels like a Dumb and Dumber skit.
It, 27 steps to not be crippled. The first one's the hardest.
All right, I'd like to welcome everyone to the Second Rate Saints podcast. I'm one of your hosts here, Caleb. To my left is...
Josh, to my left is...
I'm Colton, and to my left...
I'm Joel, and to my left...
Me, Caleb. We have gone full circle, or relatively more like a square in this regard, but that's okay. So we're missing Stuart slash Cole. Hey, I know my shapes, Joel, okay?
You really like your shapes there.
If there's anything I got like down pat in kindergarten, it shapes.
Show off.
What member are we missing there?
Two of them.
Colwert.
Stuart slash Cole. Where can people find episodes with him?
If you'd like to see over past and future episodes, you can check us out at secondratesaints.com. If you'd like to send us a message, you can just send us a message at secondratesaints@gmail.com or use the chat feature on our website. If you'd like to support the podcast, check us out at buymeacoffee.com/secondratesaints or use the link on our website. Follow us on Instagram. See what we're up to. Keep those questions coming because we got turts coming down the pipeline.
Man, that's a rough sell.
Which,
probably I don't do it, please.
Let's kickflip this segue. And
hi.
Hey, Colton.
Hello.
I heard in the last week that you learned to read.
Yeah, a little more than a week, yeah. I haven't been on the podcast in a while, and so that's I've had true. Some time to read.
Yeah.
The book I read is The Prophet Joel and the Day of the Lord by Walter K. Price, which is a commentary, technically. I have to clarify. It's wow. I don't mean that to be insulting. There's another reason why he wrote it besides just being a commentary. But I wrote a paper on Joel for one of my classes, and so I picked up a bunch of books. This book, I got some time to read. And so I read through the entire thing, only about 120 pages. And it's on Joel and what it means specifically around the theme of the Day of the Lord in Joel. It's a very interesting book. I don't want to be mean, but I do disagree with the author quite a lot on pretty much everything. But he goes through the book of Joel, writing on how the Day of the Lord starts with the locust plague in chapter 1. And it's a real locust plague that happens. However, it's hinting towards something greater. Then chapter 2, clearly not maybe a locust plague. It's hard to tell. That's basically where he goes. Yeah. I think he goes with it's purely a locust plague. For people who haven't read Joel before, locusts are a big theme in Joel. Whether or not it refers to an actual invading army or a simple locust plague is kind of the subject to debate. My answer, and the one I argued in my paper, is that it's both, but he argues it's just a locust plague because when chapter 3 comes around, the last chapter of Joel, he argues that it's a foretelling of the actual Day of the Lord that's going to come in Revelation. Mm. This guy is a dispensationalist. If you don't know what that means, it basically just means that he believes that there's different rules for different people and for different eras in history. And so, but the big distinction that he makes, which I think is pretty classical dispensationalism, is that the Jews are still held to the dispensation that they were before, and Christians are held to the new dispensation. So they're not under the law, whereas the Jews still are.
Mm-hmm. Exclusive covenant theology. Very fun.
Yeah, it's not great. Especially considering most of the people in the New Testament were Jewish, but
yeah, no Jew nor Gentile doesn't really hold up under that.
Eventually that view, though.
Eventually, sure.
Hey, maybe he's still in Joel. Maybe he didn't get that far.
Yeah. The assumption is he made it to Joel from the beginning of the Bible and that's then funny. Just wrote a commentary. Clever.
The book is meant to, it's meant more for lay people or people just getting into studying the book rather than like a deep dive into the book itself. So it's written in prose and kind of a fun way that's supposed to make it very engaging for you to read. And I will say I was very engaged. He writes in a very good way. The big problem I have with it is that since he write, the book is called The Prophet Joel and the Day of the Lord. The big theme of the book is the Day of the Lord, how, what that looks like, what we would call now the end times or eschatology.
Mm-hmm.
Also a Day of the Lord is also the coming of Jesus, stuff like that. He argues that the Day of the Lord that was described in Joel, which is this big locust plague that destroyed everything in Jerusalem and kind of thing, is a foretelling of what's going to happen to the Jews in Revelation, which is that they will be gathered in the valleys and they'll get one last chance to repent to God. Otherwise, they'll be destroyed. And then he goes with the New Testament idea of that they probably many of them will repent. He's not a bad guy. But there are people who say they won't, but the Jews, that is.
And the Jews say they won't?
No, there are many commentators. Well, I say many. There are a lot of people out there who think that the option is given to the Jews, but they won't repent. Mm. And so they're still under the all nations gathered at Armageddon kind of thing in Revelation.
Mm.
Whereas here it also has that big battle that happens at the end of the days kind of thing.
Even though in Joel, now I might be totally wrong on this.
I'm ready. That's what my paper was on.
This is definitely about like Jesus and the Romans coming to sack Jerusalem, right?
Yeah. In Joel?
Yes.
No.
At the very least, you could say the Day of the Lord in Revelation.
Do you believe that destruction of Jerusalem? Do you believe that the Battle of Armageddon in Revelation is the destruction of the Jerusalem temple?
I think it's typologically fulfilled first there, yes.
Sure. Is there an ultimate fulfillment of that at the end of time?
Could be, but I wouldn't be shocked if there isn't.
Interesting, because I think that John gets that idea from not just Joel, but he uses the Joel imagery a lot.
Okay.
And so it doesn't have to be a literal future battle for it to take place, but the idea of that future judgment upon the nations
sure.
Well, is typified
here. Still would be a future battle.
Yeah.
If John is writing that, right? But
The big problem with Joel,
depends when Revelation was written.
Yeah. The big problem with Joel is that Joel argues the other way around. The argument is that the nations will be judged and Jerusalem will be the last thing standing. Mm. Whereas with the destruction of the Jerusalem temple, it's, you know, the other way around.
I mean, depends on how wild you want to go with replacement theology.
You're right. Anyway.
Because the people of God are still standing and Jerusalem was sacked.
Walter Price.
Do you want to describe replacement theology?
No. Walter Price.
Out with
we'll
old
be in here for a while.
Walter, it was a simple phrase. Go ahead.
Jesus and his followers are the fulfillment of all that came before.
Yep.
That is, the people of God have been, for lack of a better term, funneled through Judaism into the person of Christ, and now the people of God are now those who attach themselves to Christ in the fulfillment of all the things that came before.
Yep.
Anyway, carry on.
You know, when in Joel 2, when your old man will dream dreams and see visions and all that, I can't remember the quote because I didn't write my paper on that, but
go to a Pentecostal church.
I know.
Your old man will dream dreams.
It's like
your old man
will see visions. Prophet they'll go with, anyways.
Yeah. But, he argues that a lot of Joel is this eschatological hope fulfilled in a very specific way as described, because it's a way that we here on the podcast don't really like reading the Bible in a non-biblical way, a very hyper-systematic way where everything that happens in Revelation isn't a collection of things that happened before or a description of things that happened, but rather the Revelation interprets Joel in the same way that like you see the two same ideas and it's like, oh, they must mean the same thing. How do they coexist? Mm. So the Jews' Day of the Lord is different from the Day of Christ, for example, in this book. And so a lot of the book feels like it's kind of this mental gymnastics sort of thing to say like, oh no, this just applies to the Jews. But then in the previous chapter, this applies to the Christians, that kind of thing. So I'm not a big fan. He gets a lot of things, I think, just blatantly wrong about what the fulfillment of Joel is supposed to look like. at the same time, he writes in a very good way, in a way that I think is very interesting. And for more lay people to get into books, I think some books should be written like this. Just not with that very heavy theological bias that he has.
So I want to ask you two ratings.
I'm ready. Right?
If you were a dispensationalist that agreed with him to that level, mm-hmm. what would you rate
this
book?
And I'm not trying to convince him otherwise.
Yeah. And what would you rate this book?
I'd still probably give it like a 3 out of 5, simply because I don't think he makes the strongest argument.
Okay.
He kind of just says, oh yeah, in the end times, this is what this is. No proof, no arguments. He just says, oh, we know how it's going to look in Revelation. So that's what this means, even though it doesn't really line up very well.
Blind assertions, the book.
Sometimes yeah. he justifies it. He also just argues hard for a very, very early dating of the book with prose. It sounds very nice. He describes the reign of Joash and how that came up and what Joel would have seen during that, the great rises and falls of the evil queen and then the rise of the king. And that's when Joel wrote this book. Awesome. Doesn't make sense. The book doesn't really make sense based on how he argues it because of that sometimes.
Now, second rating then.
Yeah.
What is your honest rating?
I think this book does more damage than good. I'm going to have to give it a 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 5.
Oof.
Maybe a 1.5 because it's written well. The problem is I think the writing well suckers in people who might not be as critical on the opinions. Mm-hmm. I think that the theological bias is immense. Like the book is about dispensationalism, essentially. Like there is some other things that he does well. Like when he talks about the Joel passage, your young man will in the end of days, your young man will see visions and your old man will dream dreams. He says that beautiful, awesome, talking about Christians, great. And then back into the thing that doesn't make as much sense.
Even though the continuity of the passage would mean that it's about Jews.
It is the same thing. Yeah, I know. But at the same time, the prose is nice. It messes up. Josh, before you go, you need to judge the cover.
Oh, yes. The segment where we end up getting the person that's colorblind to judge a book cover.
I've got a picture.
Do you have a picture?
I feel like I've seen that book before.
Been in the library
it
for does, a while.
It legitimately has your name on it.
Yeah. It does look too much like the German flag for me to like.
Wait, which one?
The current one. No, it's an old book. I'm going to give it a 1, 1.5.
Here's the thing. I actually agree with you. I think that the picture isn't very good.
Does look like the German flag. That's super weird.
Interesting.
But anyway, that's Prophet Joel and the Day of the Lord by Walter K. Price. A book of the Bible we're not talking about today.
Josh.
Yes.
What book of the Bible are we talking about?
We're talking about 2 Samuel.
Right. And we're going to pretend like
this is in order.
Right.
We're not going to reference future chapters. Yeah, we're talking about haven't done an episode about yet.
Right.
Chapter 17, right?
Yes.
Just get worse. Just keep doing we're going to do the last episode.
I'm throwing them off. All right.
Don't, and especially don't tell them how we've done the entire series in Malachi already.
That's funny. I wish we do.
It's Malachi.
Malachi, the Italian prophet.
Yeah. We're doing chapters 4 and 5.
The lost chapters.
Yes.
To us.
Lost to us.
We forgot they existed.
Oh, man. Can you tell which pages are out of my Bible?
Yeah. So what happened last time on Samuel was Abner joins David and then Joab murders Abner.
Solid.
Yeah. So we've said that twice in 2 episodes. And now we're on chapter 4.
Nice. And so we're kind of following David's rise as king. So at first he kind of has 3 stages almost. He's anointed and then he kind of becomes like functional king, ruler. And now he's becoming recognized ruler.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Ishbosheth, Saul's son, is having issues because the only means of his defeat of David was going to give the kingdom to David. and then got murdered. So now David's pissed and he doesn't have Abner to defend him.
So Ishbosheth. Yeah.
Yeah. Ishbosheth. Yeah. So we're going to start verses 1-4 in chapter 4. When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands, and the name of the one was Baanah, and the name of the other was Rechab, sons of Ramon, a man of Benjamin from Beeroth, for Beeroth also is counted part of Benjamin. The Beerothites fled to Gittaim and have been sojourning there to this day. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came to Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled to her house, he fell and became lame. And his name is Mephibosheth.
We're going to talk about Mephibosheth more.
Mephibosheth?
Mephibosheth.
Mephibosheth.
Mephi.
More, but I do like how the text is like, she fell and then he became lame. Mm-hmm. It's almost like, yeah, and he didn't hit the ground. In the process of falling, somehow he became lame.
And he fell into a Green Day CD. Now he's lame.
That's funny.
That was a prior conversation.
Do you have the time?
That's not correct. Wait, no, it is. It is. I'm sorry. I misheard. Maybe I'm lame.
Tonight will be.
I don't want to be an American
idiot. For you.
Terrible.
Anyway,
why is this what we're doing? I'm sorry.
Welcome to Second Rate Emos.
I have some.
They don't make it that far.
Jeez Louise. Okay, none of this is going to make any sense, and I hope it's not on the internet.
Holy.
This is on the internet forever.
What does this have to do with being lame in both feet?
Oh, we'll get to that, Colton.
Okay.
Well, imagine being rich and not amounting to anything. That's the life of Mephibosheth.
Oh my goodness, Josh.
He amounts to a lot.
We will talk to about Mephibosheth later.
Mephibosheth.
I'm going to mispronounce it every time, and you can't stop
on
me.
Purpose.
Think of Mephistopheles.
Oh, that'll help.
How do you know?
Who's that?
How do you know how to pronounce that?
No, I won't. Okay, point being... Two raiding leaders, right? Kind of like, it's not entirely clear whether or not they are just part of Saul's army or Ishbosheth's army in this case, or whether they're kind of like adjunct, like scouting, raiding party type auxiliaries, if we want to use a technical term from that era.
Yeah. Considering they're both part of the tribe of Benjamin and Saul's from the tribe of Benjamin, maybe they have allegiance to him because they're from the same tribe.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that's going to be noting, like, this is the ultimate. Ishbosheth doesn't even have power in his own tribe anymore. Mm-hmm. And this is like Saul's house has been declining and declining and declining. And we even talked about it in our, I think it's in our, I don't remember the chapter, but in 1 Samuel, where like the elders are around Saul and Saul's like, I know you guys secretly really like David.
Yeah.
Right. And like the whole, all of Israel has been slowly turning on the house of Saul. And now it's even the people in his clan, right. And his tribe are slowly turning on him, which we're going to describe more about.
I mean, they haven't liked the Benjamites for a while though.
Yeah. Things got weird.
The end of Judges doesn't go well for the Benjamites. So
no,
anyways,
well, also, you know, don't do what they did.
And yeah, definitely don't do what he did.
Wait for our Judges series whenever that happens. Well,
yeah.
To further your point, the downfall of Ishbosheth, the continued downfall of Ishbosheth after Saul is the fulfillment of God's prophecy through Samuel, through the Witch of Endor.
Yes.
Which is you and all your sons will die.
Yep.
And your house will come to a bitter end.
It's going to be lame in the end.
Yes. Except redemption through Mephibosheth, which is kind of nice. But yeah, so you just see, like, it doesn't matter what Ishbosheth does unless he repents. So.
Sure.
Well, in the previous chapter, Ishbosheth was scared of Abner, so he already isn't a very strong king anyways. No. So.
Well, he inherited his father's fear.
Yeah.
So, unlike Jonathan.
That's fair enough. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is a...
Do you think Jonathan would have become king if he had lived?
Was he his first idea? Son?
Well, because we kind of talked about that.
Jonathan understood David to be the anointed king.
Yeah.
If Jonathan was going to...
If Saul was a good king, though, would Jonathan be the king? Is he the firstborn son? I actually don't remember.
I think so. I believe so.
Okay. So if David was never anointed, then it would
be. So if God's plan was different, it'd be different.
Well, no. I think
God changed his mind for some reason.
If I can piece some stuff together and make a what if, it would be that the house of Saul would be adopted like it does later on into the house of David.
Yeah.
Right. Through the marriage to Saul's daughter. And so Jonathan would still become royalty and the house of David would still reign. But David would be king because that's the one that God had planned since Ruth.
Right.
No, I want the Lion of Ben.
The Lion of Ben. Yeah.
Kind of changes the Genesis.
Well, sorry. Genesis verse. Since Joseph, this has been the plan.
Yeah, but if we're making stuff up, though, come on.
Well, no. But the point is that he's still making a good point that what if people obeyed
the line of Judah,
how does God's plan still come about? And I think it's through that where he,
you're right.
Their families become one.
Are you saying that Saul's family had a choice to follow God's plan and still be fulfilled and have that everlasting kind of union to the tribe of Judah?
I can't
potentially.
I can't prove a counterfactual, but at least it's presented in God's words where he says, if you obeyed, I would have kept your house forever.
Okay. Mm. Yeah.
So same thing he gives to,
David
Jeroboam,
yep.
which
God, obviously doesn't fulfill
because and that doesn't Jeroboam's work out too well for him.
No, but the whole point being that if God's willing to make the promise, he's not a liar.
Of course.
And so,
I agree.
Yeah. So I think it would have just worked into their families become one. In the whole idea of the church is multiple nations together. The kingship of Israel is a bunch of families together that God all promised that you would reign.
Are you saying that there's some of Saul's descendants that might still be alive today?
Well, what? Well, no. The whole, I mean, Paul.
Through Mikhail?
But Mephibosheth, he gets absorbed into David's house.
It's literally absorbed into it.
Yeah. No.
Theologically.
Yeah. Well, he's not walking it away.
Man.
Oh, man.
It's going to be a rough episode.
No, I know. I see what you mean.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
And either way, that promise to Saul, the promise that I will keep your house forever, is being fulfilled through Mephibosheth being absorbed into David's family.
Sure.
So, to his household.
Also echoes that only salvation comes through the absorbing of the only becoming part of the divine family.
Yeah. Mm.
Thus.
And aligning.
Union with Christ.
Okay. Yes. Interesting. I like it.
Thus, Christification. Continue.
Yes.
Christification.
Christification.
You mean...
That's the Western word for theosis.
Yeah. No.
I mean, it kind of is.
There's some technical differences there.
Well, yeah, they make us right.
The technical differences are the difference.
Yeah. So not the same thing.
Yeah. That's why I said West. Also why Joel said right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh.
Do you guys think... Sorry?
I know we have some East Orthodox people listening at home. They're going to love this.
It's okay. He's so forgiving. He's so nice.
Shall we go to verses 5 to 8?
Yeah, probably.
Chapter 4, verses 5 to 8. Now, the sons of Ramon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Bana... set out, and about the heat of the day, they came to the house of Ishbosheth as he was taking his noonday rest. And they came into the midst of the house as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Bana, his brother, escaped. When they came into the house, as he lay on his bed and in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of Arabah all night. And brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And they said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on the day on Saul and on his offspring. Yeah.
So
state-sanctioned murder.
Six maybe. And seven kind of tell the same story twice, but it's really clunky.
Yep.
to the degree that even like the Hebrew text is super weird and vague.
Okay.
Rather difficult. This is what one of the commentaries that I was reading was going on about. The Septuagint tries to like restructure stuff and actually add some things.
Right. Which it does a few times in the Bible. Yeah.
Yes. Although the Septuagint, there's reasons why the Septuagint is amazing, but that's,
it's pretty great.
Those reasons aren't them.
Yeah.
Point being, it's probably an attempt to like the first section is probably an attempt to summarize the thing and then retell it in detail.
Yeah. They're stabbed and they leave. They stabbed, cut off his head, and then they leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's the summary. They killed him. They went to his house and killed him. And then the explanation. Okay. So they snuck into his house and then they found him. They probably didn't enter the house twice. All that to say.
It would be kind of funny though. They go in, they stab him, they come out and they're like, actually guys, I forgot something. I left my keys.
Well,
I gotta go.
You can make the argument that it's like, well, we need his head in order to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In order to prove his death. However, it mentions that they kill him twice.
I do like the idea of them killing the king, leaving the house and going, we're going to need proof.
Shoot.
Let's go back in.
Yeah.
I got to sneak back.
Did you grab the head? No. Did you grab the head? Shoot. We got to go back and get it.
Discover he's not dead. Kill him again.
Feels like a Dumb and Dumber skit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or a Scooby-Doo plot.
Can I bring Scooby up something about Mephibosheth? Are we going to talk about him again? Is he in the second chapter as well?
No, won't be mentioned until I think chapter
like
8 or
forever,
9.
Forever, until they're like, oh yeah, and David gave him some food. Yeah,
like 2 months from now.
It's when Mephibosheth grows up, because now he's 5.
Is he?
It just says when he was 5.
No, when he's 5. When Jonathan and Saul died, he was 5.
Yes, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, I needed to address something with Mephibosheth. Preachers have abused him more than they've abused Jabez. You know what I'm saying?
I don't know who Jabez is.
You don't know who Jabez is?
No.
Wild.
So bad.
It's one of those things where it's a very specific character that people have just like seen as a point of their own self-actualization. And they're like, I'm Mephibosheth. And it's crazy. And it's like they take this overarching idea of being welcome to the house of the Lord into like this New Testament adoption type theory stuff. And I've heard...
You don't think that's
not
there?
Less than you don't six, think? Not less than 6 sermons on Mephibosheth. And I don't think he's as big of a deal as we're making him out to be.
I think it's there. I think
do you
what
think
happens,
it's a way of him legitimizing his rule? By tying the houses together?
No, because he's already married Michael, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's fair.
Right? Like he would already be there. And here's the thing, typologically, sure.
Yeah.
It's always preached as like, and you can overcome hard things. Like one of the sermons I remember listening to was called The Comeback Kid.
That's
and
funny.
It was preached to a bunch of youth. And they were like, even if you go through hard things, someone will take care of you. And it's like, what's the purpose here?
Well,
like, are we actually, this is not a promise given in scripture. This is a specific guy who's called... The crippled man.
The reason,
and it sucks.
The reason why, like, if that's what the connection is,
yeah,
then yes, that's horrible.
But can you imagine?
That's not the argument.
Sitting in the pew, beside the pew in a wheelchair, and someone's like thinking about how they're going to get through their financial difficulties because they're preaching about this crippled man who can have second chances.
No,
to me, it's just it's taken so lightly. And it's never preached in the typological sense. It's always like, he's one of those people we've made a poster child for self-actualization.
Yes.
And I don't like it.
That does suck.
I don't know if you guys had the same experience. It's sounding like it might just be me.
I think I've heard that, but I think maybe only once or twice.
Okay.
I think the connection is that Christ and David are faithful to their promises.
Yes.
Even when they don't have to be.
Yeah.
And
Mephibosheth is mentioned a few times in the chapter throughout the entire the entire thing.
He comes up later.
It's a recurring character.
Yes, because later on it talks about him sitting at the table of David.
Yeah.
But I don't believe he ever has any agency attributed to him.
I mean, he can't really do much, but yeah.
That's not fair, though. That's not it.
speaking of no agency attributed to him in his salvation, you mean kind of like Calvinism?
Not in his salvation.
Also not just Calvinism.
You think
Calvinism is not the only one that has
just Calvinism.
You think being adopted by your, you know, your dad's very good friend is like... That's not the same as salvation, I wouldn't say.
That is Jesus.
Anyways, go to
your That's very good.
Just a stepbrother, his brother-in-law,
his
right?
Stepdad, David's the dad that stepped up.
Anyways, all I want to say is go check out the Candidates Adored episodes. There's about 70 of them. Let's.
So that's my rant about Mephibosheth.
I totally get what you mean. There are passages in the Bible that are taken beyond their bounds.
Yeah.
And then super applied to like 27 tips on how to not be crippled.
Yeah. And I'm scared like,
for that 27 one. Steps to not be crippled.
The first one's the hardest.
These steps are going to be harder for some than
I think
most.
They're all the hardest, Caleb.
You know what they say? Who's going to carry the boats?
Not Mephibosheth.
Anyway, enough with the crippled jokes. I like Caleb. I agree. I think that
crippled's a bad word still, right? Like that's not. That
I
might
don't
need
know.
To be taken out.
I don't know.
Physically challenged.
No,
challenged.
You can't say that anymore.
We're quitting.
Differently abled.
The new one. Yeah, differently abled or person with externalities.
Externalities. I haven't heard that one.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's a new one.
We're the PC police, so we're going to now refer to them as that. But
Joel, you're about to say something.
No, I wasn't. I'm good. I'm done.
Caleb.
Yes.
Mephibosheth shows in the book of 2 Samuel that David is faithful to his promises that and that he protects and that those who he keeps in his house, he will maintain and whatever.
Yeah.
And it also shows God's providence through David, man after my own heart, all that kind of stuff.
I agree, Joel. It's not supposed to be a self-help story.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is something there though about God's providence over Mephibosheth?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. How does that in contrast with the because I think the reason he includes him in his house is not contradictory. I think it's contradictory on purpose of the announcement that Saul's house will die. How does that tie in?
Contradictory to the fact Saul's house will die.
Yeah, the prophecy. I mean, his house does die, but it because he gets introduced into David's house, he becomes.
You could call it some messianic imagery there with David.
Okay.
Basically restoring.
Yeah.
Or reconciling those to the true king's house, right? There's some fun stuff there.
Yeah.
Again, my issue is the pop preaching kind of thing where it's just these figures that people latch onto.
Yeah, that's fair.
And it's either bad systematics or worse topical preaching that'll make them take these characters and just abuse them, in my opinion. Yeah. But
we need more pop sermons on the floating axe head.
I agree. Yeah. No one talks
about it.
I've
heard one
enough.
Sermon on it. I've heard it was very zero. Funny.
We'll get there eventually.
Yeah.
Anyway, so these dudes kill the king of Israel.
Yeah. I don't think David's going to like it.
Well, he has a track record of being totally okay with this, right?
Nope.
Oh.
Yeah.
He killed the last guy that did it.
It's like David's least favorite thing.
I killed Saul. Isn't that pretty cool?
No.
No. You've only damned yourself.
Oh.
Yeah. Nine? Whoa, sorry.
Well, isn't this idea of like presenting the enemy king's head to the house in search for a reward? Was that pretty common during this time? Or not common, but like cutting off a pretender's head. If the idea of that is David is a pretender in this case, but Ish-bosheth is the challenger. Not in terms of right leadership,
well,
but in terms of the kingdom's eyes,
if
maybe.
The divine mandate does come from God and it is a legitimate
mandate of heaven. Yeah.
If that's what I mean, legitimately, this is my argument. If
a little different,
if monarchies rest on God's approval, if God's approval does move,
to be fair, this is the specific requirements for this specific monarchy.
And here's the thing.
But ask the people who their king is, and they're going to, most of them, except for Judah, are going to tell you that it's Ish-bosheth.
I'm not wrong.
You know what? I'll give you that.
Okay, verses 9 to 12. But David answered Rechab and Baanah, his brother, and sons of Ramon, the Beerothite, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life out of every adversity, when one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. How much more than wicked men have killed a righteous man on his own house, on his bed? Shall I not now require this blood at your hand and destroy you from the earth? And David commanded his young men, and they killed them and cut off their hands and feet and hanged them beside the pool at Hebron. And they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron.
Brutal.
At what point do you think in David's response were they like, oh...
Oh, when he rhetorically starts reliving.
Yeah. As surely as the Lord lives. Oh, we've done something.
Let me think what I did last time this happened. Weird that it happened twice. Especially when the first time you killed him, right? Like, it seems like that would get around. Be like, hey, don't kill the king.
Yeah. So there's a couple things that are interesting. It talks like in a previous passage, they walk all night, right? And so what's recorded in their telling of the events to David clearly is a summarized, cut down version, because they don't, in at least in the quote quoted section of, hey, we killed him and we have his head. And then David shows that he has knowledge of, you went into his house and killed him. And it doesn't appear like he would have got that information from a secondary source. Mm. So they probably told him, yeah, no, we broke into his house and killed him. Here's his head.
Yeah. Thinking that Saul would just be happy with the fact that he's, we'll give you the kingdom.
Yeah, that David would just be like, this is good. Yeah. Whereas at least the other guy was like, yeah, he died in the field of battle.
Do you think there's connections between David's repeated, no, I'm not going to take the kingdom from somebody that can give it to me, and Jesus's denial of taking the kingdom from Satan?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's something I was going to ask, because that's a good point. That's why I asked if this was common during this time. I don't know if you know, Caleb, or Josh, or Joel.
I don't know about this specific time. I know it's common.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, to kill the pretender.
You see it after, but I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the idea would be is that there's good reason why they expect they'd be rewarded for this. It's probably happened elsewhere in the ancient Near East, right? Yeah. And so in that case, is this also a sort of, like you say, Jesus's rejection of Satan's kingdom, is this sort of a test of faith on David to see if he will stay true to his promises and what his principles of not killing Saul and Saul's family kind of thing?
It might not be a specific test. Like, it's not presented as a test.
Sure.
But it is, like, for the reader, a doubling down on, no, this is David's character. It's continuing with the method of, no, we do not kill the Lord's anointed. And apparently that passes down to your family, your household. So he won't allow people to kill God's chosen ones, because he calls him a righteous man, even though he's,
which is wild, actually.
Which I'm thinking that means, because if he is God's anointed due to the family promise to Saul, that he's not considering him righteous for what he's done, but because of God's anointing.
Yeah.
Right.
And so if that's the case, then what David is hoping is, because like the confrontation in Samuel and in Kings and Chronicles is, God will make dual promises for eternity, that I will bless your household for all generations. Yep. And you'll be king with an unending throne. And then I've denied that, you're no longer king. Get away, new guy's in charge. And I think through this story is what you're seeing is both promises are fulfilled through David not killing Ishbosheth or Saul.
Okay.
Because they're still God's chosen one to be king. And them being destroyed by other means, and those families being absorbed into the divine family, meaning both ends, it fulfills both promises. The house ends, and they continue reigning.
Yep.
And ultimately the best option would be, like with Saul, is he should have given the kingdom to David willingly.
Yep.
But he didn't. And Ishbosheth didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And
it is interesting that the civil war kind of began at the pool of Gibeon.
Mm-hmm.
And now it ends at the pool of Hebron.
Yeah.
Right. The civil war is closing. It's I don't know.
This is just, it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bookends. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
Good thing they never have a civil war ever again.
His young man, definitely not. Do you think that's his merry men from his Navy SEALs from
SEAL Team 6?
SEAL Team 6.
More like the French Foreign Legion. Because they're all like other nations people, remember?
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. That's cool.
Mighty
do
men.
You think these are the guys from Gath? Because they call them his merry men sometimes. They don't usually call them the young men.
Mighty men.
Mighty men. That's what it is. Yeah. Merry men's Robin Hood. That's so funny.
For a second.
Robin Hood.
He was basically Robin Hood for a bit.
Yeah. Robin Hood is a David figure. So
messianic figure.
Yeah.
Okay. But is like,
how is he not, Caleb?
Is Captain America a messianic figure?
Falls in love with the king's daughter.
Is King Arthur a messianic figure?
Is going around.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, that one's fair. Yeah.
Going around and in the countryside being hunted by the king, and
pretty much any king that's the first king is a messianic figure.
There you go.
Yeah. Or a tyrant. One or the other.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Cyrus the Great. Anyways, continue.
Anyways, Krishish.
What?
Oh, his name pronounced in art.
Who?
Sorry, I'm
Cyrus.
Cyrus.
Oh.
Yeah.
Krishish.
In Persian. Yes. Verses 5:1-5 of chapter 5. A lot of fives. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and at Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah 33 years. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites." That's the next verse.
David's king.
He's finally
a bunch of Jesus numbers there.
I mean, he was already king, but
yeah,
no, I'm just kidding. But the people recognize him as king.
Yeah. And their argument, like, so all of them come and they go, "Hey, we're of the same, like we're blood related. We are relatives." Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Also, even when Saul was king, you were the one that was kind of leading us. Your leadership has been shown. Also, God's giving you the crown. So like,
can bygones be bygones? Come on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And it's not entirely clear how many of them were already leaning towards David, even while Saul was alive.
Right.
Yeah.
So
they kind of hint in, not that these specific people are, but that the nation itself was already turning to him.
Yeah.
It's very heavy in the first one. And even at the beginning of this book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, Joe. Yeah.
Do you think this use of the term shepherd, like you shall be the shepherd of my people, actually informs like pastor? Like, is there an authority there for pastors based on this use of shepherds?
Very
like,
interesting.
That's what I'm saying. Like, or a better way to look, let's look at this from the other angle. Is him being called shepherd combining his king and prophet kind of, you know, a king and his priesthood, right?
I don't see it at all.
David, you don't see it at all?
I don't see it at all.
I see the prophet one. More.
Yeah,
because okay. That's
a more
Moses
defensible position than does this make pastors kings? That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think for
that's
both
what Moses talked about. Yeah,
I think for both Moses and David, though, this is specific to them, and they were both shepherds for a long time.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I think it's drawing heavily on their context and their relationship on how they led.
Yeah,
in their life.
I think it's a cultural articulation of what do rulers do? What do leaders do?
Yep.
And if that's how that culture is going to predominantly be.
Mm-hmm.
Fed and like a massive subculture within it is shepherding and that sort of stuff.
Yep. And when Moses announced that there will be one like me that comes after, all that kind of thing, who guide you and shepherd you and stuff like that. There is probably a tie here. I wouldn't doubt it.
As proto-Jesus,
As proto-Jesus. Well, that's the thing. It's the tying of that idea with kingship, specifically Davidic kingship.
Yeah.
Which then is fulfilled fully in Christ.
Who's not a shepherd, technically. But then he's the biggest shepherd.
Yes.
He says he's the shepherd.
Well, and then he's
a carpenter.
Yes.
What does he build? Sheep gates.
True. He is the gate.
I rest my case.
And the sheep.
No, he's not the sheep.
Yeah, because we're his body and we're sheep.
Yeah, also man, he was also the lamb.
He was fishing for that one.
This is why everyone here hates systematics. This is why they hate.
He was a sheep. Just read Revelation.
Joel, I think.
No, he's right.
So Joel, I think to your point, like, I don't think that it's talking about like David is taking like a pastor role.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just inverted where it's this informs the use of pastor shepherd in the New Testament from Jesus and then onward.
It helps show what the purpose of the shepherd is.
Yeah. I agree with Josh.
That's a rare statement from Caleb. So
that's true.
Caleb.
Guys can't fist bump when you're sitting there.
Our audio listeners, 4 meters away.
So there's two numbers that are significant. He starts his reign when he's 30, and Jesus starts his ministry when he's 30, and then David reigns in Jerusalem for 33 years, and Jesus lives for 33 years.
Yep. And they had 6 years or 7 years in between, right?
Nope. That David did. Anyways, but we've got two big Jesus
numbers. The destruction of Jerusalem was in 70 AD. So it all fits.
There you go, a number.
It all fits.
For our dispensationalist listeners, this makes sense.
Yes.
If you read the book of Joel.
No. Numbers are the same thing regardless of the context in which you're making them.
True. Yes. Anyway, it is. He does reign in Hebron for 7 years and 6 months. Is that the time that he spent also, like before conquering Jerusalem? Of course, he moves to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. There is in chapter 6, is that when that happens? Is that when he moves to Jerusalem? I can't remember.
I don't remember.
Because the Ark of the Covenant is brought to Jerusalem.
That is in the next chapter.
Which we've already done. Yeah.
Well, I tried not to explicitly
say it. I was there for that episode. So
I wasn't.
I can.
In that case, is this the period of time from him kind of being independent from Saul after Saul dies to that point? Or is it from this point to that point?
I would think that it's from... I would think that it's from like Saul's death, give or take.
Because I've seen different people argue on this. I would have thought that it's from this point, his anointing, because it follows obviously the anointing story and then gives a general cap of when he reigned, kind of like what Kings does sometimes.
Yeah, that's fair.
But
you could go either way.
In that case, he's in Hebron for quite a while, but it's kind of skipped over a little bit in these chapters.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, doesn't really matter. It's just interesting that he skips over his reign in Hebron, if that's the case, because it's basically a chapter that he's in Hebron and then he's in Jerusalem. But then also, I haven't read all of 2 Samuel yet, so maybe I am misunderstanding how this book is meant to be read. Either way, I just think it's interesting how long he spent here.
If the timeline gets weird. Because there is like the repetition, like it says 40 years and it tells you like what the different times were, where he did spend different times. And oh man. And you have the issue of like, when did the civil war, like Caleb was saying, like beginning at Gibeon and ending at Hebron. Weird.
Also Chevron, the gas company.
Oh my goodness. Josh.
What?
Is named after the capital of city of
Hebron.
Hebron.
That's cool.
Really? Is there chevrons on like a uniform?
I was going to say, it's the uniform.
Why is that their logo?
Yeah.
That's what it became.
No.
When?
That's on the town hall in Hebron.
That's actually the symbol for Hebron, actually.
Yeah. That's David's symbol.
I'm double right.
The chevron of David.
True.
The most known Jewish symbol.
The pool of chevron.
That's so... It's just a gas pool.
Wow. This is something else.
Don't
guys.
Light a match, guys.
Don't light a match. It's fumes. Mm-hmm. Gas fight.
So, okay, no, I'm going to let you read the next section before I comment about it.
That makes sense. That's how the episode works.
Yeah, but I can be bad at it.
Let's violate structure and do the next two chapters first. Wait.
Caleb does have a history.
Whoa. I think it was more than just me on that episode. I missed multiple episodes. I come back and go, okay, did we do these chapters? And you guys, yes.
For the record, I wasn't there for that.
It's totally my fault. I'm so sorry.
Verses it's everybody. 6 okay. to 16. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites and inhabitants of the land, who said to David, "You will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off," thinking, "David cannot come in here." Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And David said on that day, "Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul. Therefore, it is said, the blind and the lame shall not come into the house." And David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built the city all around from Milo inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. And Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and cedar trees, also carpenters and masons, to build David a house. And David knew that the Lord had established him king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David. And these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shammua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua,
Nefeg.
Yep. Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet.
Good job.
Thank you.
Good job, Colton.
Thank you.
So funny to see which one of those got popular, eh?
Purely on the ease of pronunciation.
Eliada, of course.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. There's two instances like where, not two instances, there's instances in history where people like dam up a waterway and then like go in through that, right? Mm-hmm. It seems more like he's coming up a well.
Yes.
Which,
yeah,
there's... People argue about the archaeological evidence of such a thing happening, but it's interesting if you do want to go down a deep dive, look into the...
It is interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, Josh, you can say things.
I wonder if... Do you think there's a parallel here?
Between him and Cyrus the Great?
Sorry?
Yes, but no.
They use the same tactics. Anyways, continue. Yes,
with a river. Well, no, and Solomon's Tunnel leading out.
Yes. Solomon's Tunnel?
Like as an escape, and like
yes,
David, I think, enters the city the same way that Solomon builds an exit.
There could be there
and
could
the well that it's talking about is that waterway.
I know that one of David's things he does later is it David or is it Solomon? I can't remember, but they build a more powerful aquifer underneath the city that brings in water and brings out water that feeds the city so that it can't be sieged.
Yeah,
with water being taken from them, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Solomon.
That is Solomon? Okay. Yeah. Either way.
You can go through it when you go to Jerusalem.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know if that was just an expansion of what existed here.
I would assume
which
would
be what the argument would be, right?
Yeah. What do you think it means where it's like the blind and the lame will keep him away?
Hmm? Do you think it's that like David wouldn't attack harmless people like that?
I think so, because it immediately brings up, you know, because he hates him with his soul. It's like, whoa!
Classic war propaganda.
If I had to guess, also, because I read this a very different way. Maybe it's my translation. I read the NIV instead of the ESV. But they obviously say, you can't get in here because even our lame and blind are stronger than you, is essentially the implication. Even they will ward you off. And then he goes in. Beats them anyways. It's written in a very just quick way. It's fun. Then he says, haha, those lame and blind. Mine has quotations around lame and blind. Implying that he is talking about all of the people because they are not followers of God. Therefore, they are all lame. They are all blind and in the wake of him. So in this case, we'd be talking about Gentiles and not talking about the actual lame and blind people. But then it's taken later to think that means and blind people.
I guess it would depend at the end of 8, whether it's the therefore it is said the blind and lame shall not come into the house. Yep. That works both if they're blind and lame and if that's a reference to Gentiles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think
it works just as well if it's the former.
Also he defeats Jerusalem by attacking the lame and the blind. And Jesus defeats Jerusalem by saving the lame and the blind.
Yeah.
Like his ministry is that he goes to the weak.
Yes. And so is David's.
Yeah.
Different. His ministry, man, is killing the lame and the weak.
Well, the Jebusites were labeled as one of the ones who are for destruction by God.
This is true.
Yeah.
And in this case, do you agree that the way that David, or that they mean it towards David, is that the city is so strong that even our lame and blind men will beat you? The city's so well defended that he couldn't do anything against any of them, even the weakest people.
I don't think so. Okay. I didn't think so, at least.
Okay. Well, then. Never mind. I was going to have a second question, but you beat me.
No, that's fine. Let's pretend I did. Yes, I agree.
In the second one, when it does have them in quotation marks, lame and blind, he's not meaning it to actually mean the lame and blind people. Because at least based off of the first interpretation.
Well, those quotation marks aren't there in Hebrew.
No, I know. But the NIV includes them to show that he isn't being
Yeah.
That they think that the Hebrew doesn't point to him being directly actually meaning it. Because the second verse that comes after that saying that that is why they say this thing happens. Mm-hmm. That the lame and blind will never enter the palace.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Isn't this where Mephibosheth is brought to live?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's funny.
Well, I mean, it's not funny, but it kind of shows that like it
is a redemption of the idea.
It's a redemption of the idea, but it does go to, I think, Colton's point, which is that the lame and the blind, even in that context, is supposed to, I don't know, show
not
off
literal.
It's not literal, but it could be just some propaganda towards the
propaganda. The my favorite. The books of Samuel are just propaganda. I love it.
They're not just, well, they are just propaganda, but you have to have a very nuanced understanding of propaganda.
They aren't lies.
That's not what propaganda means.
That's what most people mean when they say propaganda.
I think my favorite reference in the propaganda thing was Joel going, oh, the Bible wants me to believe something? Yes, it does.
Yeah. I'm there.
Yeah.
That's fair. Anyway.
Maybe.
Enough talking about blind and lame people.
Without just going into the Hebrew. And like doing a deep dive into it, I would think that the NIV probably just has smoothed out an interpretation.
Okay. Yeah, I agree.
And it could even be the right one.
Sure.
But they've probably made it a little bit easier.
Okay.
At least that's a rule of thumb. Whenever you see massive distinctions in different translations, it's like, okay, there's clearly some
editorializing.
Yeah. And there's somebody's taking an interpretive leap in order to help smooth out the idea when actually the Hebrew is probably a little more vague.
Sure. Yeah, I agree.
That's why you should read more than one translation.
Yeah. A lot of Samuel is a bit vague in its details, not as much in its message,
which works if you go towards an editorial and a view of Old Testament scripture.
True.
Anyways.
So David's doing real well.
Yeah.
Captures a fortress city.
Oh, that wasn't a joke about the well. Okay.
Yeah, that works. I didn't think of that. Man, I should try to be funny.
He gets a house made of the cedars of Lebanon, which is when you establish a kingdom, there's a couple things that were common in the Middle East that you would do to establish that, yes, I'm legitimate, which is, you would win a fight right after you were crowned to establish, I am the leader of this country. You'd get something built with the cedars of Lebanon, and then
they're all the rage.
Yeah.
just a fad.
Including the temple was built using cedars from Lebanon.
Yeah. Which was like the point that not just that it's a temple for the Lord and it's awesome, but that the Lord was king.
Mm-hmm.
Over Israel. Yeah. And then it kind of tacks on. Anyway, so he took a bunch of more wives.
Yes. Which foreshadows a certain.
That's never been a problem child ever. Of his.
Yeah. It's also not, you know, explicitly said not to do in the law.
Also, you can tell there's potentially been some editorial because it just labels Solomon's mother as a concubine and not as a kidnapped individual.
I mean, many concubines were prisoners of war.
Yeah.
We've said this before. David is a warlord. He's just a warlord for the Lord.
Yeah, but the context of concubines there. It does.
The warlord for the Lord is not what we're calling this title.
Warlord for the Lord is excellent.
No, he's a warlord and his war is for the Lord.
Not for this episode, but we will use that later.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Shall we finish? Last section?
Yes.
Anybody got other words?
Shlomo. I was just going to say concubines shouldn't be considered like prisoners of war. It's more like, hey, you killed their husband. Now your house has to take care of them. But let's keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a hot take.
I don't know. That's a hot take.
Means
that's
prisoner
the
of
most
war.
Optimistic take on what concubines mean. But
yeah, that's why it's a hot take.
Yeah. Is the idea show that he has many wives and concubines here is both a genealogy thing, which was very important, but also to show. Is it also supposed to show that God's providing him with sons and daughters, which becomes a big theme later on in the book?
Yeah.
He's correct.
I think so.
And also, when kings become kings, their harem gets huge.
True. He already takes on Saul's concubines, right? Is that a thing that happens? No, it's Ishbosheth who tries, and then Abner tries to sleep with one of them. Never mind.
He does sleep. I'm pretty sure it's successfully.
And then he threatens Ishbosheth.
Ishbosheth's like, hey, what? And he's just like, I could screw your entire kingdom over.
I will kill you if you touch me.
And you know what? I'm going to anyway.
And then he gets murdered. The last few chapters. We're going to read the whole book.
The rest of the book. It's going to be a long episode. Okay.
Verses 17 to 25. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, all the Philistines went up to search for David. But David heard of it and went down to the stronghold. Now the Philistines had come and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up to the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand." And David came to Baal Perazim. And David defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breaking flood." Therefore, the name of this place called Baal Perazim. And the Philistines left their idols there. And David and his men carried them away. And the Philistines came up yet again and spread out the valley of Rephaim. And when the Philistines inquired of the Lord, he said, "You shall not go up. Go around to their rear and come against them in opposite of the balsam trees. When you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then rouse yourselves, for when the Lord has gone out before you to strike down the army of the Philistines." And David did as the Lord commanded him and struck down the Philistines from Geba to Gezer.
So there's not quite like Saul, hey, dude legitimately named serpent in the wilderness that you defeat. Yeah. But the pattern is the same.
It's pretty bad. Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Even the Rephaim or Rephaim.
Well, yeah.
A little bit.
The Nephilim reference.
Yeah, Nephilim reference in this part, which is cool.
Yeah.
I don't know this.
Yes.
The Rephaim is one of the lineages that trace back to Nephilim.
Yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. And so when it says Valley of the Rephaim, it's like, oh, this is what we're associating with this.
That makes
and they're
sense.
Philistines, which have giants among them.
Yeah. You could also graft this whole entire concept just into
Goliath.
Serpent seed theology.
Yeah.
So,
yes, but I'm not going
not
to do
directly.
That.
Yeah. Yeah. You could do the fundamentalist.
I am.
You could do the completely literalist. These are serpent seed and sons of the devil, or the more theological take, which
No, you don't get it. Fundamentalist means it is the most mental of all fun. This is the best interpretation.
Whatever I choose to be is right.
So David has a name among the Philistines now. So it is kind of wild that it's like, oh, David's in power now. We have to snuff this out as soon as we can.
Yeah.
They're like immediately.
He's the last guy we want in charge.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And so it's just fair. Part of that is
he
based
cut
on
off
his
200 foreskins like 20 years ago or something like that.
Well, then he killed their champion and then went to work for them.
He goes, yeah. Hey, I heard a position just opened. It's like, yeah, dude, you opened it with a sword.
That is true. That is what happened.
Yeah. But the thing that I noticed was it says, and the Philistines left their idols
and they carried them away.
And they carried them away, which is a complete reversal of the beginning of 1 Samuel.
Yep.
Which is they took the ark.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so at this point in Samuel, you essentially have a solidified Israel. They finally have the king that they were asking for so badly. But it's also God sanctioned in this sense.
And more importantly, David asks God, which is the opposite of what Saul does.
Yes.
Yes.
And the opposite of what Israel did with bringing out the ark.
Yep. Guys, Israel is so back. Let's go.
We're so back. It's so over.
Nothing can happen. Nothing bad can happen from here on out.
No. Definitely not. The rest of the book is very happy. For sure.
Everything works out for everyone.
Abner? Who's Abner? Not Abner. Absalom? Who's Absalom?
Never heard of him. So next time you can go and listen to a previous episode where we recorded the next chapters.
Yes.
Yeah, chapters 6 and 7 were all re-recorded. If that wasn't very clear, you can put that already.
We went back in time is what you're hearing right now.
Yep.
That's our newest thing, time travel. Anyways.
Just invented, just for the podcast, though. We won't use it for anything else.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Tenet next. Christopher Nolan movie.
The way to make money with a time machine is run a podcast.
And release episodes.
Go back 2 weeks in the past.
Man, technology's getting whack, hey? Are we finished up with these chapters?
I think so. I think, well, we're done for our main topic. We normally derail at the end, and we've started to.
I tried to mention Tenet. Nobody answered me.
Tenet's pretty good.
No.
Let's just read Samuel as Tenet now. We should have started at the end of 2 Samuel and then have two series, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, meet in the middle, and then like no one understands anything, much like Tenet.
Tenet is a completely coherent.
Okay, so if you're going to put a biblical theology of like Tenet inspired, it's going to be new creation. New creation and old creation, ultimately finding its like root in the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, right?
See, that's the right answer. I thought you were going to go with Eucharist.
That is part of it, yeah.
Oh.
That's not a part of the plot of Tenet.
Yeah.
I remember when they go down and they bow before the cross.
Because I gave you a book to read doesn't mean I agree with the book. You should know this. You read books that you disagree with all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
At least I certainly hope you disagree with
them. This book is by Hans Borsma.
Good book.
It is.
I don't agree with it.
What book are we talking about?
This is Eucharistic participation. Here's the thing.
Okay. Did we ever cover? I think we did cover it on
twice.
The
so Eucharistic participation.
Guys, this isn't a Eucharist episode.
Is now as a book. Works. Mm. I think it takes too many presuppositions.
Yeah.
And it attempts to essentially arrive at a rather systematic conclusion without trying to do systematics.
Yeah. It also very heavily leans on some verses and doesn't on others.
Yeah. But I think it's right where it does lean on a lot of verses. I think the reason why it feels weird is because it doesn't flesh it out with the others.
Sorry. Yeah. That's what I mean.
It's not as though it gets those verses wrong. Anyway.
Yes, I agree.
Tenet.
Tenet is the movie version of Hans Borsma's Eucharist Participation.
It's a wild adaptation because you wouldn't be able to tell.
A lot of changes from the source material.
Yeah.
The plane is going backwards. I don't get it. Anyways, part of it. It's a different thing. I fell asleep during that movie. And then I woke up and I got even more confused because I fell asleep during the part where the two timelines fuse. And so I could figure out what was happening.
You need to watch this movie.
I may have destroyed
again.
This, the end of this podcast. I'm so sorry.
I might have just destroyed the whole podcast. I don't feel too bad about
Tenet
it.
Tenet is also kind of an analogy of how biblical theology works. There's some forward in time and there's some back in time references.
He's right.
Yep.
I don't think that's what Tenet's about, but.
No, yeah, I said
Tenet's not just about linear time, Josh.
I said Tenet's like.
You give him 30 seconds till he says God's outside of time.
No. Go from here to Matrix, whoa. Josh. You can do it. Matrix jump.
Yes.
David lives in the simulation before. Because he knows he's king.
The main character
he becomes king.
Of Tenet is called the protagonist because he's just a character in a story.
You can't just talk about stories.
In the same way that we're a creation and Christ is the protagonist. which means that the character in Tenet is a Davidic character.
Or an archetype. One or the other.
Very much an archetype.
Yes.
Also, David's a type. So
David's your type, eh?
You can't say archetype, can you?
I'm going with David's an archetype.
I'm gonna go with David is Josh's type. Anyway,
is Jonathan's type?
No, he's an ectype.
I would say he's an archetype. He's an archetype of a good king that Jesus fully fulfills, which makes him a slightly different archetype.
But he can't be an archetype.
Yeah, he would be an ectype because he's not the fulfillment of the image.
He is an archetype in Kings and Chronicles.
He's not like the full, like archetype. We'll figure this out after.
If he is an archetype, then he wouldn't be the highest explanation of that. Of the type.
He is the archetypical good king.
Okay.
Jesus is more than just that. Like, he's not just David. He's other things too.
Yes, but I would say David is the closest typological fulfillment of that archetype. And the archetype is most expressed in David. But David is not the archetype himself.
Okay.
The archetype transcends the particulars.
Yeah.
Sure, I agree. Now we're talking about general Bible typology. I'm talking about like the good king in terms of like how the timeline of the Bible. He's the archetypical good king for the Jews until it's fulfilled in Jesus temporally.
Okay.
He is the king that everyone wants to be.
Okay.
Going forward. Until obviously Jesus is the better king, thus usurping the title of archetype. Sure, I agree. But he is the Jewish goodest guy.
The goodest.
Except for the times he does bad stuff, which we'll get into.
Joel, do you want to wrap this up?
Yeah. This has been Second Rate Saints. If you'd like to follow everything we're doing, check us out at secondratesaints.com. We have a chat feature. We have a donate feature. If you'd like to email us with your longer form questions, you can email us at secondratesaints@gmail.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/secondratesaints. Yeah, almost forgot about that one. This has been lovely. It's been a while since all four of us have been on the pod, so it's good to it's good to finally see you guys.
Thanks for getting through the dry spell where we didn't release an episode.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We really appreciate you. Specifically you, listener.
You.
That's good.
I hope that's at the end of this episode.
Joel! I was listening to a book today on spiritual discipline.
But not microphone discipline, apparently.
No, that's a different thing.